From the forgotten food deserts of the city, to the hot dust of Central Valley Farms, to the shining superstores of Walmart, Tracy McMillan knows the American foodscape better than anybody because she's worked there for minimum wage and less.
In order to make minimum wage, you had to pick 5 buckets of garlic in an hour, and nobody I met could do more than 4.
Join us Wednesday, March 28th, 4 to 6 p.m. on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio as we interview Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. And you'll find out something about our food supply.
Saying, look, we don't have any public control over the distribution of our food, and we've ended up with all these food deserts and a really terrible quality of our food supply.
Join us with Tracy McMillan on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio this Wednesday, the 28th of March, 4 to 6 p.m. on KBBF FM 89.1. Thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. I'm your host, Daniel Kirvine, and on the phone with me is Tracy McMillan, who is the author, among other things, of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. And I have a number of questions. This is a book where the author, and there's not the usual kind of way of doing research. There are some of the really famous books and the hard-hitting kinds. Actually, the author does this. It's kind of along the model of Gloria Steinem and some of the other authors that have gone through. And instead of just reading books, there's a lot of background information, actually went and worked at a Walmart, went in and worked in the farm fields as a farm worker and at an Applebee's, and got to experience firsthand and see firsthand how the food we eat is processed, how it's picked, who's doing it, where it's coming from, and some of the odd things that happen on the way to the dinner table. So, Tracy McMillan, thank you for joining us here today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So, I've noticed, now there is something that has actually made you famous. In my point of view, it has made you quite famous, and we'll get into that. It has to do with Rush Limbaugh and national radio, things of that nature. And before we go there, I want to really be talking about you, because I see that you've won several awards for social justice journalism, and that has a lot of value with Shift Shapers. Now, what or who are the influences that have been in your life that you see having put you on that path?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question. I get some version of that almost all the time. And, you know, some of it's really basic and really personal. So I grew up in a working-class neighborhood outside of Flint, Michigan, so in a little rural town.
Mm.
My dad sold lawnmowers for a living, and my mom was real sick. So, you know, my family, we weren't ever hungry, and certainly, and there's a big sort of cultural cultural preference for not relying on any sort of public benefit in that part of the country. And so, we never got or looked for public assistance in any way. But my family really struggled a lot. And certainly, I felt that strain as a kid. I'm the oldest of 3 girls.
Uh-huh.
And so, as anybody who's been in a difficult family situation will know, like, the oldest kid takes on a lot of responsibility today.
Oh, yes.
And so there's a degree to which, I was just growing up in this environment where it was very clear to me early on that there were a lot of structural reasons that my family was struggling. So my mom was real sick, and the health insurance company was arguing that they didn't have to pay for her care. So that caused a lot of problems for my family. That wasn't because we didn't work hard or we didn't care about her, right? But it was
mm-hmm.
something that we didn't have a lot of control over. And so I've always been really interested in getting a handle on sort of the structural constraints that folks are operating under. As I got older and moved into work as a journalist, I've been inspired by a lot of different writers. I mean, one that reviewers have really picked up on with The American Way of Eating is Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed.
Yes.
Where she went and worked in 3 jobs in low-wage work to sort of talk about what welfare reform had created, the sort of world that welfare reform created. So that was obviously a big one for me. I think the work of Eric Schlosser is really inspirational in terms of, really taking a serious look at food. And even Michael Pollan, who certainly
looks
at this from a different perspective than I do, I think has done such a great job of making the case that food is something that's important, right? And certainly my work wouldn't make sense without that sort of groundwork having been laid.
Isn't that interesting? That's really, because we sometimes if you look around, it seems as though we live in an environment of food, especially in the United States, that there's food everywhere. And what your comment about that food is important, it is very interesting because I think we just throw something in our mouths and we don't really quite think about what it even is.
And I certainly grew up in a part of the country where that's absolutely the case. Nobody took food seriously. And if you did, it was understood that if you were talking about what kind of food you really liked or if you were going to be picky about wanting a different kind of vegetable than another, you know, that was something that snobs did, right? That wasn't culturally considered appropriate where I grew up. And at the same time, it's not like the people I grew up with didn't care about what they were eating or that they didn't care about their health, but there's this sort of interesting little mismatch between, you know, people caring about their food and then feeling like if they actually say that out loud and articulate that even to themselves, that therefore puts them in this sort of disaffected, removed segment of society that isn't necessarily engaging with what reality is like for a lot of working people.
I see what you're talking about, because you can be marginalized if, for instance, you're a vegan or something like that. Is it that the type of thing? Or if you're mainly looking for organic food, or you have specific things that you decided are high on your priority list. Is that what you mean, things like that? Or that'd be nutritional?
Yeah, I mean, I think somewhat. So it's just really interesting to me, the older I get, right, to sort of notice that when I was growing up, right, we didn't really talk about food. Yet we would talk about, we wouldn't really talk about food as if it was important. Not that we wouldn't ever talk about what we wanted to eat or what we thought would be good or trying to get better quality, but you just sort of mindlessly ate because that's what was there. And I think even when I was growing up, there was still, like, the idea that food would make you sick, like, hadn't quite sunk in yet. Like, this was in the early to mid-80s when I was small, and I've talked with a number of folks who do health work in immigrant communities, and mm-hmm. that's always a real big stumbling block for them in doing nutrition education with folks, because folks are coming up from these, like, very rural, impoverished backgrounds in, you know, sort of Latin and South America, coming from these very rural food cultures and coming to the States and being confronted with supermarkets and the idea that food could make you sick just by eating it, not because you were necessarily eating way too much of it or anything like that, but just the idea that food could make you sick does not compute, because why would it, right? Like, it's
right.
Not like animals out there are necessarily like, oh, food will make us too sick or anything like that, right? So similarly, I don't think humans think, you sort of have to explore your idea of food a little to be like, oh, all that processed food might actually make us sick.
Which gets very interesting when you wrote about having lived when you were in New York in a food desert. Trying to find fresh vegetables was really a chore, and it really didn't turn up very often in some of the places where you lived. And when I compare that to the immigrant experience coming here from those countries you described, where you go into the supermarket and there's tons of everything, and I could look in there and say, well, that's junk. It's full of corn syrup. It's garbage. It's full of lard and all this other stuff. But it's a cornucopia if you are coming from a place where maybe you haven't had enough.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, I have a very hard time at this point, particularly having lived and eaten off my wages in each of these jobs, right, judging people for choosing convenience. Because usually there's a compelling reason besides laziness that people are choosing convenience. And I certainly found, I tried to keep an eye on myself and really be true to what I felt like I would be doing if nobody was looking, right? Because one thing that's really easy to do, I think, if you're doing an undercover journalist thing, is that you, like, try extra super hard to be extra good at whatever it is that you're doing because you know you're going to write about it and you want to look impressive. And I really tried to be honest about what I really felt like doing in terms of my food, right? Because I was keeping very close notes. And once I got to the point where, like, I really didn't have any of my, like, startup fund left, and I was down to, you know, like, it was me, some yeast, and raw flour, and I was either going to be hungry or I was going to work on making bread for 2 hours, right? I didn't really like cooking anymore. And if I could have afforded, you know, to just buy some already made bread, I would have totally done that. And then I was, you know, working on the night shift at Walmart. If somebody had come up to me and been like, well, you know, Tracy, you just should try a little bit harder, and you really shouldn't get that, you know, I think a couple of times I forgot my lunch, so I bought like a frozen, you know, Hungry Man meal or something, you know, out of the freezer section and nuked it in the back room, right? You know, you really should try a little harder and plan a little harder. I mean, I would have just told them to go take a hike. I mean, when you're working that hard and your resources are that limited, this idea that it's just so much easier if you just would stop being so lazy about your food, it just becomes really, really offensive and incredibly alienating. So no matter how right someone is about, you know, it's not that hard to cook, it's not that hard to get some fresh vegetables necessarily, I don't know that it matters if they're right, because nobody's going to want to listen to that if you're lecturing at people like that.
Right. And one of the things that you point out, there are a couple of things that I want to point out about your book, and I'm talking to Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. So one of the things that you've done is in your chapters, when you talk about how you lived when you were working as a farm worker, actually picking fruit, actually picking garlic out there in the fields, and then working as an employee, a minimum wage employee for Walmart, how you managed to budget for food for yourself, and you laid out how much, what percentage of your pay had to go out for food. And what I started to see is that the landscape, the foodscape for someone who's on minimum wage or is even sub-minimum wage as a farm worker is in cans, it's in packages, it's how you make a buck get a little more for you. So you've really put the information in there. That's one of the things that's well supplied in the book, The American Way of Eating.
I'm a reporter by trade, so of course I want to have facts and everything in there. And I felt like particularly with the food budgeting, it was really important to have hard numbers in there, because it's the sort of thing that people talk about all the time in vague generalities, and they rarely get specific. So people will say things like, you know, American food is cheaper than anywhere else in the world, and we spend less on our food than, you know, than most other industrialized nations, which, you know, is true. That differs dramatically by social class, or at least the share of income that we spend on food differs very significantly by social class. So, you know, the American family on average spends about 12% of their income on food. But if you're looking at the top third of American income earners, so that would be households at $70,000 a year or more, they're spending about 9% of their income on food. And if you're going down to the bottom third, you're looking at folks spending the upper end. So this is families making $25,000 to $35,000 a year are spending around 16%. You start getting down below $25,000 a year, people are spending 20, 25, 35% of their income on food. And that's a lot of America. I mean, the third of American households below 35 grand is the fastest growing demographic in the country in terms of income class. Those folks are already, like in a way, they already prioritize their meals very highly, their budgets. And so if we want to have a real discussion about changing how food works in the U.S., I just feel like you've got to start building a dialogue and a rhetoric that makes sense for those folks, because there's more of them than people tend to give them credit for.
Well, I'm going to extend a metaphor here, and I'm talking to Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, and say that this is a very nutritionally dense book. I mean, if you're looking for a book that has a lot in it to back up what's being said, and also the kind of subjects that it covers, it's speaking to economics, nutrition, health and safety, labor issues. You have quite a bit in there. It looks as though that's how you approach things. And I'm wondering, first of all, is this your first book?
Yeah, so this is my first book. I've done a fair amount of narrative reporting, so long-form investigative narrative work. And sort of taking on things in this complex way is just kind of how my head works, what I like to do. And particularly for something like this, food is such a complicated thing, and there's all these different pressures on as citizens, as eaters, as parents, as friends, on our time. I really wanted to try and get at some of that complexity instead of trying to reduce it down to it's just access or it's just culture or it's just this. You know, I really wanted to have sort of as full a picture as I could muster of sort of all the different ways that what we eat gets shaped before we sit down to dinner.
How long did it take you to write this?
Yeah, so it took about between 3 and 4 years, depending on when you start counting. So if you start looking at when I first thought I might do a book and start trying to come up with a really good idea, you're looking at 4 years. If you think, oh, well, what about once you got the idea? It's probably more like 3.5. And then, you know, it's just under 3 years from sort of pitching the book, getting a contract, and then having it published. So I pitched the book in April of 2009, and then its publication date was late February of this year.
How much of this work had you done before you actually put together your book proposal? Was it were you well underway with the investigation you were doing?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay.
This is soup to nuts, everything. I mean, from zero to 60 over the course of 3 years. And I'd done some advanced reporting in terms of just some very vague, broad statistical stuff. I mean, so there's a little bit of reporting, but almost everything was done after I got the contract. This is the sort of project where you absolutely need some degree of financial support from somewhere else. And,
right.
You know, and I still was struggling very much. You know, I was on food stamps for the final year of the project. I'm still paying off debt that I've incurred to family and friends to get it done.
I'm talking with Tracy McMillan, who is the author of The American Way of Eating, as published by Scribner's. And so their advance to you made it financially at least possible for you to go and do the research and go work for a minimum wage at Walmart and sub-minimum wage in farmers' fields and be able to produce this amazing level of depth in your book. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way advances work. I mean, I certainly had to fundraise. I certainly had to look for support elsewhere to get through the full 3 years, you know, but a lot of that I just ended up finding in-kind support, you know, so getting housing from friends of friends, free office space in Detroit. So in Detroit, the alternative weekly, the Metro Times, gave me one of their extra desks to use for about 9 months. So I had free office space, I had free housing. So I just hustled.
Yeah. Well, I guess that would be a big piece of it. Yeah. And so people around you are backing you up on this project. And what, out of all of this, what are some of the things, the leading things that you have learned from it about the world of food and marketing, this reality, like you said, about that food is important? What are some of the things that you have learned about that from doing this work?
One of the things, and this is a slightly softer frame of how to talk about this, but one thing that has really stuck with me is just how complexly people appreciate food and how ingrained that is. Usually, particularly with working class folks and who don't necessarily think of themselves as foodies, you have to peel back, you know, the discussion a little bit. You can't just say, like, why do you eat that? Oh, you like that crappy food, huh? But if you ask them, you know, well, why are you drinking the Mountain Dew out of the 2-liter on your break and eating a bag of chips? Like, why? You just really like that? And they're like, well, it's okay, but it's cheap and it's here, right? Which is a really different thing from saying, given all else being equal, I prefer chips. Right, and being able to have that conversation and to really spend that time, I've just been really struck by how much people actually do care about eating healthfully, eating fairly good food. You know, we can be complicated about whether it has to be local, sustainable, organic, and whatnot, but, you know, people care. Mm-hmm. Nobody's really running around saying, I love diabetes and I want it, you know. And so for me, that was this really big sort of way to shift my thinking about food, because it's a really different approach than we've taken when we're trying to think about changing people's diets and getting people to eat better and things like that. Because, you know, for my entire life, the approach we've taken publicly has been to lecture people and to not really engage with why they're making those choices other than presuming it's a lack of information. You know, and I would sort of argue that, you know, we haven't seen that be very effective in terms of shaping people's diets for the better. And so wanting to really engage with that. So that has been sort of the biggest takeaway for me. And then there's some of the smaller, more concrete things. So things like the fact that farm labor, even in California, which has the best regulations on the books in the country, farm labor is essentially unregulated in terms of enforcement.
It is, you know? It comes down to the enforcement, usually for things that are regulated, doesn't it?
It does. And the other thing would be really the threat of substantial fines.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that was also interesting to me, because I did, you know, a bit of corporate orientation working for both Walmart and Applebee's, and something that came up repeatedly in the orientations is they would say, well, if you screw this up, there's a really big fine, so don't screw this up, because that's going to cost us money. And it's really interesting, because you will hear sort of corporate executives say, well, you know, we're happy to comply. We don't need regulations. Like, we don't need all that muss and all that fuss. And you know, sort of my thinking after going through those orientations is, well, it clearly gets you to behave properly, right?
Doesn't
you're
it,
that
though?
Worried about it. So why, again, would we not want to engage with that as part of the toolbox, right? Like, obviously, you don't want to make it impossible for businesses to do business and to generate income, but you also have to have some protections in there for consumers and workers.
Well said. And what are some of the things? Now, you went into the fields, and it's very well described. You went into the fields, and you were a novice at...
Oh, yes.
Let's see, you started off, was it onions you started off with, and then you
I
went to garlic?
I started off actually with grapes, and
grapes,
then
that's what
I sold food to some onion workers, along with my Myrdoma. And then I moved into sorting peaches in the Central Valley. And then after I got heat sick from the peaches in the heat, I transferred to the Salinas Valley. Mm-hmm. And there I found work cutting garlic.
That's where the garlic is, yes.
Yeah.
Gilroy.
No, substantially south of Gilroy, and actually there's very little actual garlic production in Gilroy at this point. Almost all of the cultivation has moved into the Central Valley, in fact. So the Salinas Valley, where I was at, is actually it doesn't even show up, really, in state statistics on garlic cultivation.
Well, the myth lives on, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. They do a very good job with marketing that in Gilroy.
But what are some of the things, like, out of the world of the farm worker that surprised or shocked you? Did you get to see a presence at all of farm workers' unions? I know you were working in California where you just remarked that there's actually has been a lot of headway by the farm workers organizing, but just a little bit about that.
Sure. So most of the farm worker organizing in the country obviously was happening during the 70s, 60s and 70s with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. And they certainly got some great gains, and they continue to do some really good legislative advocacy. So there have been some compromise bills and things like that passed. There a presence here in California as well as in D.C. on those issues, and that's really powerful. On the ground, there's not as much sort of organizing in the fields of new crews. So the UFW right now represents about 5% or less of the farms in California. They're really not present outside of California. It's possible, maybe in like Yuma in Arizona. And for the most part, farm workers are just out there. In many places, there are sort of worker centers. So these are less formal unions that often do a mix of community service type stuff. So, legal services are really big. So California Rural Legal Assistance actually had a broader presence across the state here than did the UFW. So they've got, a whole slew of offices around the state. And they're typically very small, maybe one or two staff, but they're often folks who speak indigenous Mexican languages, which is really important because about a third of farm workers in California are indigenous.
And Spanish is not even their number one first language.
Right, so Spanish is something they all learn in school,
except
that they go to school, and then also speaking it, obviously, in Mexico. So I had this sort of humbling realization that my Spanish probably wasn't nearly as good as I thought it was. It's just that everybody else spoke really bad Spanish, too.
It makes sense to me that there would be the rural legal assistance would have a presence there because immigration issues, I'm sure, are really big and a huge sort of shroud over the life of someone who is a farm worker. Many undocumented, as I recall you, we're talking on another radio program about how many are undocumented.
Yeah, I think it's around 50% is the official statistic. Most people I talk to who have worked in the field think it's actually much more than that, but it's very hard to track that sort of stuff.
Yes. And I'm very fascinated, too, about the work that you did at Walmart. Now, and you have a lot to say about that part. I mean, actually, there's a lot that you find that it's saying about our American, not only way of eating, but also our food supply itself.
Yeah, well, something that really started to fascinate me the more I dug into reporting on Walmart and looking at how the food system works, and looking at how pricing works at supermarkets. So, I sort of wanted to deconstruct a little bit about how the price of food actually works, right? So if you're buying something for $3 at the store, what does that cover the cost of? Because it is not what you learned in elementary school, which is someone produces a good and then someone sells it and that the difference is the profit, right? Like it's much more complicated than that. And what I found is that supermarkets now, particularly big chains like Walmart, they don't even compete with each other on price anymore. They've sort of figured out where the price points are, and they'll play with it a little bit. Really where they're figuring out how to make more money is by increasing their profit margin, which is different, because what they can do is they can push down their costs.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of how supermarkets have reduced costs over the last several decades has been by introducing different kinds of efficiencies with distribution and transportation and logistics and sort of building these logistical empires so that not that Walmart is just this place where we buy food, it's actually, you could sort of think of it as this like vacuum tube in between the farm and the store. And it's just this one huge consolidated tube, right, for the food mm-hmm. moving around. So Walmart's actually a distribution system as much as it is anything else. And that's something that I came to feel really alarmed by, because Walmart currently controls on average 25% of America's groceries. Like a quarter of our food supply
is controlled
and sort of manipulated by Walmart.
Wow.
And in specific neighborhoods, it's in fact much higher than that, you know, because, you know, Walmart, it's not like Walmart is 25% of the market in every town.
Right, they
what
tend to drive out.
What it is in a lot of small towns, it's 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of the market. And then in, you know, bigger and more diverse areas, right, it might not have the same kind of market share.
And it's the nature of their business that they drive out other smaller mom-and-pop markets and things like that.
Right, and that's part of their business model.
And they, I think, developed, I read a history of Walmart, and they developed the just-in-time inventory setup, which is that only what they need in the next day or two is what shows up.
Right, which is also something that's really interesting to think about when you start thinking about it in terms of a food supply, because that's certainly more efficient. But there's a writer named Barry Lynn based in D.C. who does a lot of reporting on sort of Walmart and modern business. And he was pointing out, you know, it was inefficient to have several days' worth of goods sort of in transit or, you know, at the store. But, you know, that's actually a pretty flexible thing to have in place if there's an emergency, right? So if every store only has exactly what it needs for the next day,
yes.
If you have an emergency show up in that area, right, you are out of food in a day.
That's right.
Whereas, you know, the older models, not as efficient necessarily, but they'd have provisions that could last like a town a week or so.
And you can have warehouses right in the general vicinity too. I mean, this stuff gets hauled long distances.
Right, so Walmart is in control of all these distribution centers and sort of setting all that stuff up. And interestingly, you know, so much of the produce in the country used to go through the produce terminals, right, which were these sort of public marketplaces, usually funded mm-hmm. through a mix of private and public dollars. You know, so there'd be some government oversight, but it was still a marketplace, you know, functioning like a market. And so up through the late 80s, early 90s, you know, the Department of Agriculture would keep tabs on the amount of food coming in and out and where it was going, you know, just to get a sense of it. And they stopped because supermarkets had gotten so big and taken up such a market share into their private distribution networks that USDA just said, well, this isn't worth it. We're not getting an accurate picture because most of the food goes through these private networks.
Oh, interesting.
And we have no way to track those, so we'll just stop counting altogether.
Right.
Which, you know, because I was, of course, trying to figure out, well, how does food get into Detroit?
Yeah, right.
Where does it come in?
And how much?
And how much and where does it go? Everyone's like, we have no idea. We can't tell you that.
Well, there goes my next question, because I was going to ask you, since most of the items that are sold at Walmart come from China, does the food also come from China? We might not know that.
Right. Well, I mean, the one thing we do know is that currently the American food supply produces just about half the fruits and vegetables we would need for every American to eat the recommended allowance of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that really compelling and interesting, because you're like, why do people eat such crap? And you think, well, part of it might have to do with the fact that we don't organize our food supply in any way to make sure that we actually have enough fruits and vegetables for everyone.
We're growing a lot of corn.
Yeah, we grow a lot of corn, grow a lot of soy. We put a lot of taxpayer dollars into, you know, that kind of agriculture, and we've done very little to make sure that we're growing food that's actually good for folks.
And I'm talking with Tracy McMillan, the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. And, you know, as you can tell, a lot of my questions have been a great deal of interest in Walmart and in the what it's like to be out in the fields and what's to be learned there. But I see that you also did a stint waiting tables. You were not one of the people waiting tables. You were one of the people managing that it was getting to the plates. So what did you get from that and glean from that experience?
Sure. So when I was working at Applebee's, I got a position as an expediter. So that's the person who's in charge of managing the traffic sort of the kitchen, and so my job was to coordinate the orders as they came in, make sure everything was, you know, sort of moving forward as orders came up, coordinating the different plates of food together, getting all the dressings on them and the lemons and, you know, coleslaw and things like that, and sending it out to the tables. So that was really interesting to sort of work in a place where labor was that rationalized. That was really interesting. But what was really fascinating for me was to get a couple of stints in the prep kitchen and back. And so that was where I sort of got a much better look at the kind of food we were making and what we were serving. And very little of what comes into an Applebee's is made, is sort of prepared fresh. Meat
it looks
comes
like
in
it
frozen
is.
And then is defrosted. Soups, all that stuff is either made from a mix or it comes in frozen and then gets defrosted.
And that's it.
That's it. I mean, the only fresh stuff that comes in as a whole piece of something are hides of iceberg lettuce and whole tomatoes, and that's because they've got to be put on the burgers.
Yes.
Everything else, the lettuce and the salads, comes in pre-chops, right, some big bags, you know, which dries out much more quickly and has a lot less flavor usually. You know, all the coleslaw and carrots, that comes in pre-shredded. So, you know, a lot of it, I just sort of felt like, you know, this would be like me making really quick and easy food at home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to go out to places like this, like, if I have any choice, because why would I be spending $18 on a steak dinner that I could make at home for $3.50?
There's a big element of franchising, and that this may be a side effect of having everything be what Adam Smith called it, the economy of scale, where you have so many. If you have one restaurant, but you make it a chain, and you have hundreds, you start to get to where your factory, you're making the food like factory food.
Yeah, it just really felt very industrialized, Applebee's,
mm-hmm.
and I don't begrudge anyone going to Applebee's when when you're traveling. Like, that's fine. And I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with going to Applebee's for an evening and you're just like, you know what? Tonight I am so tired, it is absolutely worth spending five times as much to have somebody else make the food and, like, do the dishes. I'm totally down with that. And that's totally fine. But I really just came out of that experience feeling much more cognizant of sort of the cost-benefit analysis that I wanted to be doing when I was going in to eat at a restaurant. I just really felt like a place like Applebee's, you know, I have Bisquick at home. You know, I can buy bagged lettuce all on my own and put, you know, bottled salad dressing on it too. There's really no reason to be paying somebody else really good money for that.
Yeah, there's rotisserie chicken. I mean, you'd have the whole nine yards, the whole meal.
Yeah. You know, if I'm going to go out to eat, I'm going to pay somebody to make food that I can't make myself in 10 minutes or less.
Right. And I'm talking to Tracy McMillan, who is the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. One other thing I do want to mention about the book itself is that, and I like this touch too, because what you've done is you actually have footnotes, but you don't interrupt the story with a bunch of little numbers all over the page. You have notes, you have a section of the book called Notes, and you have your backup research for things that you've said on various pages of the book. So if somebody really wants to go and find out what's behind that statement on page 245, let's say, you can go to the notes. I haven't seen that very often in a book. What brought you to structuring it that way?
Part of it, right, I'm an investigative reporter, so I have to do 90% of that work anyway.
Yes, right.
Because, you know, I'm sitting there always, like, making sure that I've vetted my facts and I have them straight. And I did think that there was enough stuff in the book that felt like it would be easy to just, you could sort of sit there and talk and be like, oh, whatever, she made that up, and blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to make it very clear, this is a book that is reported, right? There's nothing in that book that I'm saying just because I feel like saying it. I'm saying it because I went and I did research, and that's the conclusion that I came to, and I try and explain how and why I came to that conclusion. For instance, when Rush Limbaugh was talking about my book on air.
Let's talk about that.
Right. A lot of what he was talking about was this concern with me sort of saying, look, we don't have any public control over the distribution of our food, and we've ended up with all these food deserts and a really terrible quality of our food supply. Maybe we should think about what kind of control we want as a public over that. And by the way, Walmart, not necessarily great produce. And I came to that conclusion because I have documented extensively that when I was working at Walmart, saw all this moldy corn, and I have pictures of the moldy corn. And I threw away all this asparagus, and I can tell you which page in my notes from my day were from the 200 pounds of asparagus that I threw out. And all of that is heavily documented, and I wanted to be able to say, oh, really? Well, look at my research and tell me what's wrong with that, because this is about starting the conversation. It's not about me making a declaration, but about me saying, look, this is what I went out, this is what I found, let's talk about this, and if you disagree with me, here's my research, so let's talk about what I got wrong. instead of just having people sort of as a knee-jerk say, oh, I don't really like what the conclusion you came to, so you must have made it up.
And what occurred was that Rush Limbaugh on his program, Rush Limbaugh, who's a right-wing commentator, and he, I don't know whether it's because it was Women's History Month and it was just another woman he could attack, I don't know, but he started this whole thing. Grace McMullen, a liberal woman. I don't know if he exactly said that, but he was making this case that if people really read this book and took it to heart and it became, they approached their legislators, all food would cost more. It would be just this disaster, and that's kind of where he went with it, right?
A little bit. I mean, it was, I don't think that's a little more sophisticated, actually.
Okay, I think it might have been, yes. I think the first thing I said.
I mean, because I wrote a piece at the request of Corby Kummer from The Atlantic. I wrote a response piece for them. And so I sat down here and I really read through and the transcript of that show and analyzed it. And really what Limbaugh does is he states a series of true facts and then declares that they prove his point of whatever it is. And so his point and talk about my book was that there's a war on freedom and there's a war on private enterprise. I would be hard-pressed to pull that conclusion out of my own book, right? But, you know, that was sort of the analysis that Rush had of the reporting I had done. And then and he sort of went on that track for about 40 minutes. Then at the very end, it sort of devolved into him saying, you know, what is it with all these single white women, overeducated, doesn't mean intelligent? And, you know, and really that's what got people upset, because you can sort of argue with the content of a book or not, but implying that women are not supposed to work their butt off to get through college and get a job.
And now
like
we know
that's a whole different level of, you know, sort of offensiveness.
And now we know who his audience really is.
But certainly not women.
No. But getting at this, something serious here is some futurists are predicting that with the decline of oil supplies and the rise in prices, there's a lot of that being predicted. And it's actually starting to happen, you know, tar sands and things of that nature. It's getting harder to get the oil. That mega stores like Walmart that depend on goods being shipped huge distances could have trouble continuing, keeping their supply lines together. And either gradually or very quickly, they could even go under. And I'm wondering if you see something in that, those huge extended supply lines being vulnerable to oil or fuel shock, and whether that in itself could affect our food supply if we rely on that entirely, or to the point of 25 or 50%.
So the current sort of food supply chain we have is very brittle. So it's very efficient, but it is not flexible at adapting to change. And certainly if you see a spike in fuel prices where, you know, shipping food around the world becomes much less practical, that would pretty quickly have an effect on Walmart's ability to deliver food into neighborhoods. And that's another thing that I just find really problematic, is that you have one company responsible for a quarter of our food supply. And it was bad enough when the car companies were too big to fail. You could, in theory, come up with other jobs, right, within a period of time. Society starts to break down a lot faster when there's just no food.
Yes.
And, you know, that really worries me. I haven't done any specific reporting, you know, on peak oil or what the effect of spiking gas prices would have on Walmart, but it's certainly something that I think if you start extrapolating out what's likely to happen if sort of international shipping rates go way up, it doesn't look very good.
Well, I want to thank you. Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion here with it's been a wonderful interview. I really appreciate you being with us here on Shift Shapers. Is there anything in conclusion you'd like to say about what you're telling people with your book?
Not really. Just thank you so much for having me. Folks are interested. You know, I hope you will buy the book. I'm independent, so it actually really does help me. And I look forward to talking with you guys again sometime.
Well, I will spell out your name so people can find it easily. It's published by Scribners, Scribners. And your name is Tracy McMillan. That's spelled T-R-A-C-I-E. The last name is M-C-M-I-L-L-A-N. And is there a website to find you?
Sure, either TracyMcMillan.com or The American Way of Eating.
The American Way of Eating. How easy is that?
I'm sorry, there's no the on the website.
Oh, okay.
American Way of Eating.
American Way of Eating. All right. And I'm sure it's easy to Google those, too.
Yeah. You Google me, I'll come up.
Indeed. Thanks again, Tracy McMillan, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.